Welcome to The Megyn Kelly Show, live on SiriusXM Channel 111 every weekday at noon East. Hey everyone, I'm Megyn Kelly. Welcome to The Megyn Kelly Show. Columbia caves. A midnight deadline came and went for the anti-Israel protesters to remove their tents from university grounds and disband their so-called People's University of Palestine. People are paying $70,000 a year to send their kid to this school and allowing this. And indeed, perhaps it was all part of the plan because Columbia's politics were no mystery to anyone applying there. Instead of holding fast to their deadline, Columbia extended the negotiations, giving the protesters another 48 hours. For those of you hoping your child would continue to be educated there, too bad. Apparently, the two sides are going back and forth, trying to negotiate a deal. Okay. How's that work when your three-year-old is throwing a fit over not getting the truck in the store aisle at the grocery store when you're just trying to get out of there? Do you negotiate or do you say, we're out of here right now? You abandon the groceries if you have to. Why? Because you don't teach bad lessons to a toddler because it encourages similar behavior. Just before the deadline, the university's chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine, which pretty much at every turn has espoused rhetoric that makes it closer to Students for the Death of Jews, accused the university of intimidation. Then outside on the lawn, a masked man told the protesters to be ready over the next 3 days to turn out quickly if needed to defend the encampment and their fellow comrades. This video from Jessica Schwab, student reporter for the Columbia Spectator.
We are entering a period of high alert for the next 3 days. And that is why I urge all of you to talk to your friends as well and let them know that we may need people to turn up quickly, en masse, in front of the encampment to defend the encampment. Will you be ready to rally for your comrades?
Yes, please. Help save your fellow comrades, some of the most privileged people in human history who pay, I guess it's $90,000 a year to attend Columbia. Oh, help band together, comrades. The oppression. The administration claims they backed off the deadline after the students complied with fire department safety requirements. Oh, what a concession. And vowed to remove discriminatory and harassing language from the encampment, like Al-Qassan's next targets. Remember that? The woman praising the military wing of Hamas, encouraging them to target those annoying Jews standing behind her. God, if only they could get, is that harassing? Is that a problem? Maybe she's gone home. The administration called this progress. At the same time, Hamas terrorists have just published a new propaganda video. And these are the actual Hamas terrorists, not just their supporters in, you know, college campuses across America. So the actual Hamas terrorists have just published a new propaganda video. And I've got to tell you something. We don't air these videos and we're not going to air this video. But to me, and it's disturbing to see, it was good news because it harkened back to a story that we brought you about an American hostage. And before I show you this, I want to set it up for you, okay? He was an American who's living in Israel and he was kidnapped on October 7th. And we knew the name of 23-year-old Hirsch Goldberg Polan because his mother came out publicly and we read this piece on the air. Do you guys remember this? His mom wrote a piece, her name is Rachel Goldberg, in the New York Times. And the title was, I Hope Someone Somewhere is Being Kind to My Boy. She wrote, Hirsch, our oldest child and only son, was camping with his best friend at an outdoor music festival near Israel's border with Gaza when Hamas terrorists began firing. We later found out Hirsch and his friends managed to escape by car, but they were forced to stop and take cover in a roadside bomb shelter. Terrorists then attacked the shelter, blowing off Hirsch's arm from the elbow down by machine gun fire or a grenade or both. According to witnesses, he was ordered into a pickup truck. She wrote, I want things to go back to how they were before Saturday morning, before I saw Hirsch's text messages that alerted me he was in grave danger. I love you and I'm sorry, she quoted him as writing. But here we are, stuck in the awful present. If he is still alive, how much longer can he survive? His wounds are grievous. I hope someone somewhere is being kind to him, caring for him, attending to him. Every single person in Gaza has a mother, or had one at some point. And I would say this then, as a mother, to other mothers. If you see Hirsch, please help him. I think about it a lot. I really think I would help your son if he was in front of me, injured, near me. Well, it appears, based on the references made in the hostage video and the appearance, Hirsch is alive. We're only going to show you an image of it. We're not going to play the video, but you can clearly see that his left arm is missing from the elbow down, and you can only see him from the waist up. But otherwise, he appears, at least in this video, to be, relatively speaking, all right. We know from reporting done by CNN's Anderson Cooper back in October that Hirsch's arm was blown off after terrorists threw grenades into a roadside bomb shelter where Hirsch and several others were trying to hide, as his mother documented. Again, you can see him here in this video from when it happened, when he was taken captive and put in the back of this pickup truck. He's in camouflage shorts. He's covered in blood. Oh, his poor family had to see this and only wonder what happened to him. He was never seen again until today. What's amazing is there are Americans across the USA today, last night, the night before, and so on, not demanding that Hirsch be released, their fellow American, and demanding justice for what was done to him and so many others. Still have five Americans in captivity there, not to mention the Israelis. They're protesting to kill more Jews. Literally, that is the chant, death to Jews, that we're hearing on American college campuses. They don't care about Hirsch or the other Americans in captivity. They care about what they see as their own oppression, where they had to get 7 hours of not eating if they happen to be arrested. They're very sorry for themselves. They're mad that people are going by filming the tents, this tent city they've built because of their privacy rights. That's what these snot-nosed kids are worried about today, or so they would have us believe. There's no better person to talk to this about than Heather McDonald. She's been writing about this exact kind of person for many years and understands this mentality fully. She's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute. She's the author of many books, but her most recent one is titled When Race Trumps Merit: How the Pursuit of Equity Sacrifices Excellence, Destroys Beauty, and Threatens Lives. Heather, I'm so happy to have you today. There's so much I want to talk to you about, but let's kick it off there. That, you know, what's happening on these campuses and the absolute entitlement and cluelessness of these students.
Well, they're up against a deadline, Megan, because school's about to end. And now they've got this perfect audience of cowardly bureaucrats and presidents and DEI officers going around pampering them and pretending that these are significant protests. It's a completely codependent relationship between narcissistic students putting on these phantom plays about rallying to each other and comrades. But when school ends, you know, what are they going to do? They're in these safe little enclaves, Columbia University, walled off from New York City, where they can engage in this play acting. But commencement is coming up. Commencement season is going to be very fun to see what happens there. But after that, they're going to lose their selective audience, and you're going to have to wait several months. So right now, things are accelerating on college campuses because they know they're about to lose the spotlight when school ends. The thing to remember, this is obviously a scary, scary time if you're Jewish, Megan, but this is about much more than anti-Semitism. This grows out of the fundamental ideology of the university today, which is anti-Western. Jews today are not seen as a threat to Western civilization as they were in the early 20th century. They were not clubbable. They are seen as the very embodiment of Western civilization. So at this point, they're coming. The left is coming for the Jews, and you have this mass hysteria celebrating Hamas. But the next step, and what we've been seeing for decades now on college campuses, is to tear down Western civilization itself, whether that's with regards to standards of excellence in medicine, in science, in mathematician, in math, whether it's regards to criminal law and expectations of lawful behavior. The West is in a suicide mode right now, that is one of self-loathing, and this is the absolute perfect product of the university. It's not a mistake. It's a feature, not a bug.
This would explain why these campus protests, whatever you want to call them, encampments, have the support of, it appears, most of the faculty at these right. campuses. It's amazing how we're seeing the faculty come out and support this. Places like, here's the latest out of NYU. Here's video of faculty members forming what they call a human chain around the protesters' encampment, following threats of mass arrests, which is exactly what should happen to these students. They should be arrested. And the faculty went out there to say, no, we're not going to have it. And it's not just at NYU. We saw that at Columbia and elsewhere, where the faculty are just as into the problem as the students are. One other for you. This is a soundbite from Barnard, which is right next to Columbia, where they're marching the faculty for no suspensions. They don't want any suspensions even of these students. Look at this, SOT 6.
No suspensions. Now.
What do we want?
No suspensions.
Now. Who are we coming for?
Rosenberry.
When are we coming?
Now.
Who are we coming for?
Rosenberry.
When are we coming?
Now.
No suspensions.
When
do we want it?
Now.
Rosenberry is the university president. I mean, how would you feel if you were a parent of somebody who'd sent their kid to Barnard, not expecting that they couldn't go to class, not expecting if they're Jewish that they, you know, would have to be subjected to death to the Jew chants as she walked to math?
Well, I hope it wakes up a lot of parents, and I hope it wakes up donors, and I hope it wakes up alumni, because again, none of this is surprising. You know, we're heading towards a real conflict here, because what the wise people are calling anti-Semitism for most of the campus left, as you say, Megan, they don't see these chants as anti-Semitism. They see it as a factual description of settler colonialism. So I'm wondering how much longer the left is going to put up with having the presidents now scurrying to say we've got a problem on campus when the problem doesn't even exist in the eyes of the left. Now, I would say one thing. Students should be punished if they are violating neutral rules of conduct, if they're protesting, agitating against neutral rules of time, place, and manner. But they should not be punished for any speech. Because, Megan, if we, the conservatives, the traditionalists who have been arguing that the left should not be penalizing people who argue that there are two biological sexes, that you cannot change the chromosomes in your body by cutting off your sex organs, you do not thereby make yourself a member of the opposite sex. People who say that schools are not racist, the reason we don't have proportional representation on faculty and student body is not racism, it's the large academic skills gap. That is not hate speech. Speaking the truth is not hate speech. If the right now turns around and says they want to punish these anti-Israel statements, they are going to set a precedent that will come back to haunt us yet again. And it is always eventually going to be conservative truth speakers who are silenced by any kind of speech code, by any capitulation to the idea that hate speech somehow falls outside of the protections of free speech. So I think as hard as it is to listen to these chants of from the river to the sea of, you know, Intifada revolution, celebrating our martyrs, we have to know this is going on. It is a clarifying moment. Bring it on. The more these students chant, these hateful chants, the more the public finally learns what has been going on college campuses for the last three decades.
So let's just spend a minute on that, because I know our audience should know that you're a lawyer as well, went to Stanford Law. Where do we draw the line? Because you and I would probably be kicked off campus for just saying the things about gender that you just said, and you've gotten harassed off campus for saying even less controversial things. But we wouldn't be allowed, even at a Ron DeSantis, you know, school in Florida, a state university in Florida, to go onto a campus and find a group of trans kids meeting together for support, to surround them and chant death to the tranny bastards, death, death, death. That would be targeted harassment, right? So like there is an amount of free speech, or I agree, hate speech is protected by the Constitution, but you can get to the level of targeted harassment where you lose your right to say the thing and you get kicked off. Like, I really think some of these stories, and I agree, like from the river to the sea is, I don't think that's going to do it, but death to the Jews and here's Al-Qassam's next target right here, the, you know, right, these Jews, right? You're getting a lot closer to speech that could be like problematic legally.
Yes. I still would say that context matters. And unless it is really, really targeted at a specific individual, these are still basically ideological chants. I don't think anybody really feels like, I mean, it may come to this, and let's just hope it does not, that somebody hears a chant like that and picks up a knife and stabs a Jewish student. Yes, I guess if your example of death to trannies, I guess I just feel like to silence that sentiment prevents us from knowing what these students have been taught. And again, we're not saying this is happening, that the right is saying this. What this is overwhelmingly coming from the left, and I want to hear that.
So even if the university could censor it under its free speech policies that prevent targeted discrimination or bullying, why would they? Because it's exposing them.
Right. It's a clarifying moment, and I think that apart from very, very specific targeted threats, it's also a mistake. And I'm sympathetic to Jewish students on campus, but they are starting to use the same rhetoric of safetyism, I'm unsafe on campus. And there have been actually very few assaults. I sound like I've got a very low standard here, Megan. It's pathetic that we're having to say, well, things are okay, because nobody's actually, in very few instances, of Jews actually gotten beaten up. You know, we're not yet at Kristallnacht. But given the ideological context in which we're living, in which it is right wing or conservative, truthful speech that is silenced all the time, we've got to allow it on the left so that we can try to use this moment to say, okay, you, University of Pennsylvania, Harvard, if you guys are claiming we can't silence this because we are so committed to free speech, well, okay, well, tell us about Amy Wax, tell us about, you know, Carolyn Hooven at Harvard, who voluntarily resigned because she was so harassed by saying that sex is biological. You can't have it both ways, left. You cannot censor the right and at the same time claim that free speech demands that people go around chanting, celebrating our Hamas martyrs.
It's so crazy, because when you zoom out and you know, Caroline Hooven is a good example. When the right gets canceled on college campuses, and as I mentioned, you've been subjected to this, it's like one speaker who came on to give a lecture that's well thought out and has some heterodox ideas. And these universities are 100% fine with that. And then look at this, full encampments, preventing Jews from going across campus, forming a line so that they can't come into the encampment, like being excluded. We saw at the one university where they were held in a library that, you know, where people were banging on the doors against them, threatening them. Free speech. That now the university is going to stand up in favor of our favorite principal.
I would say this, you know, Trump has said something close to this. And of course, the media went absolutely crazy. But it's true. Frankly, let's be honest, Megan, liberal Jews have been supporting their intersectional allies. This should be a wake up call to them. I don't know how they vote for the Democratic Party, because this ideology of hatred towards the West, of victimology, is spreading. It is now basically the official credo. I don't care what Chuck Schumer says. I don't care what Nancy Pelosi says. It is the official credo of the Democratic Party. You have the Biden White House, who continues to jam racial preferences, racial quotas, sexual preferences through every federal agency, through every science granting agency, into the universities, into K through 12, demanding trans brainwashing of children. This is what the Democratic Party is about. And we are seeing its hateful, ugly face on college campuses. This should be a major, major theme in the coming elections. If you want more of this type of hatred, vote for Democrats.
It's so true. It's been amazing to me to watch since 10/7, some of these liberal Jewish Americans have the light bulb go off on top of their head. I'm thinking of, for example, Bill Ackman, right? This billionaire investor, and he's been very outspoken about now DEI on college campuses. And I appreciate people like Bill Ackman, who's got power and influence and a lot of money, joining the fight. But there are many who have been fighting this with every fiber of their being for years, like you, hello, and have been called every name in the book without any support from people like Bill. And it's like a great, you know, pick up arms, rhetorical arms, and fight right alongside of us. But some humility for the fact that you missed it all while it was happening, in my view, is in order.
Absolutely. And again, the Jewish donors that have finally woken up, don't let it end here. Don't be bought off with, oh, we're going to add anti-Semitism training to the portfolio of DEI. That was Bill Ackman's original proposal when this all started. And he said he was so shocked that Jews weren't included in the marginalized groups of against the majority on campus, you know, as if the majority, there is no majority on campus. The one victimized group that's on campus these days is heterosexual white males. They are screwed. They are the last to be hired, the last to be admitted. They have to be three times as good. Of course, the Asians have to be 10 times as good as anybody else. But if you're a heterosexual white male, forget it. It's over for you. But Ackman's initial position was, well, gee, you know, the Jews are oppressed by this somehow phantom white WASP majority. He gave that up. There's still a lot of people holding on to that. And it's frankly hilarious. I mean, these protest signs of Queers for Palestine just shows how fundamentally ignorant Americans are about the world. They live in a bubble of victimhood, so they apparently don't even know how people in Muslim countries or in the Middle East, Muslim Middle Easterners, treat queers. Good luck holding a gay pride march in Gaza or on the West Bank. Good luck doing that in Nairobi. Good luck doing that in Africa. So the intersectional coalition is now, it's holding together fine, except for Jews. And of course, Jews should be really kind of miffed about this. They were essential to the civil rights movement. They were essential to the anti-apartheid movement. And Blacks are screwing them over. You have South Africa dragging Israel into the world court for genocide, which is a preposterous claim. And you have the majority Black politicians now siding with their Palestinian brothers in victimhood. This is ridiculous. And claiming that Jews are somehow the main threat to Blacks and to Palestinians, all of this is complete fiction. So this, again, should be a movement to basically shut down as much of the universities as we can, create as many alternatives as we can, and for people to speak up for Western civilization, which has given us the very foundational ideas that the left uses against the West: equality, tolerance, human rights, limited government. These are all exclusively Western ideas. They came out of no place outside of the West. They didn't come out of Africa. They didn't come out of China. They didn't come out of Arabia. They didn't come out of India. And now the left uses the bounty of beautiful Enlightenment ideas to try and tear down the Enlightenment. There is something sick in the West right now. We are a self-canceling culture. The great replacement theory is real. I've decided to destroy our birth rate and to flood our country with cultures that en masse are not compatible. We cannot assimilate the number of people who are coming, and we've decided we don't even want to try. And of course, the most galling thing, Megan, is that the left in the morning says the US and Europe are the most oppressive places on earth. They are fundamentally hostile to people of color. Their grounding ideology is one of white supremacy. That's their line in the morning. And in the afternoon, they say, any country that does not have open borders, any Western country does not have open borders to allow as many millions of people want to come from third world places of color, that the West is then oppressive. You can't have it both ways. You can't say that the West is endemically lethal to people of color and at the same time say we want as many people of color to come in illegally into Western countries as possible, because that's where their lives will be improved. It's make so up true. Your mind. You get one or the other. You get one or the other. You either say the West is racist, or you get to say everybody comes in. You can't say both.
That's right. Or as they now put it, it's not safe for brown and black bodies. It's not safe for brown and black bodies. This discussion is reminding me of a couple of headlines I retweeted today from the Babylon Bee, which is always great in these situations. Here's one. Columbia protesters clarify they only want death to America after America is done paying their student loans off. Yes, exactly right. Here's another one. Palestine protester tries to argue with skinhead, but they just agree on everything. That's right. The Jews are bad. Yeah, same. I feel the same. And then there's Columbia student leaves lecture on microaggressions to attend Kill the Jews rally.
Well, you know, it's all continuous. If you feel like you are the victim of microaggressions on campus, and that claim of victimhood has catapulted you to the top of the victim totem pole, you have a lot of power and you get drunk with power. And, you know, you started, Megan, with the Columbia administrators sort of tiptoeing around the tents and saying, well, we're going to give you another 48 hours. That's because at the same time as we have this profoundly radical and hate-filled ideology of sort of make-believe radicalism and Marxism on college campuses, you have at the same time the very epitome of a capitalist ideology, which is the student as consumer, and adults creating the, you know, the climbing walls and the Starbucks cafes at every corner on college campuses, and redoing the dormitories to have every amenity. You know, I visited Yale several years ago, and in the Berkeley dining hall they had tastings of different extra virgin olive oils from Italy. And at the same time, you know, the Yale students, the minority students, are out there claiming that they're so victimized, they're throwing tantrums against the renowned sociologist Nicholas Christakis, telling him to shut up and, you know, who the fuck invited you, because we as black students are so victimized in college campuses. At the same time, they have virgin olive oil tastings. It's a profoundly decadent environment that is about anything but knowledge. These students should be down on their knees in gratitude. Yeah.
Here's the New York Post on what we're seeing at your alma mater, Yale, where you went undergrad. decrying capitalism while munching on fresh sushi Monday. Yep. While supposedly, by the way, engaging in a week-long hunger strike. So, okay, pick a lane. And then they go on to write, but the festive atmosphere continued even after some were arrested, as some protesters paired off to do some salsa dancing, wide smiles plastered on their faces as they took a well-deserved break from denouncing free enterprise and their university, $85,000 a year to attend.
Where do you begin? I mean, these are the most spoiled people in human history. You know, we thought that the monarchy was bad, but I'm not actually would have been in favor of it. I think authorities, right, you know, they were great artistic patrons. I love the Habsburg Empire. I'm in Vienna, and I love they supported a style of music, of architecture that is unparalleled in its beauty. But, you know, we think, oh, those spoiled kings and aristocrats that lived off everybody else. These students are living off of everybody else. They are completely self-involved. They have no idea what it took to create the prosperity that they take for granted. Every fabric, every material around you was the product of this extraordinary 400-year race to create knowledge, to transform human existence from what was millennia of the most squalid, disease-filled, poverty-stricken, famine-stricken existence where you barely eked out, to now our problem is obesity. We're so successful. Capitalism, free market economy has been so successful that we are drowning in goods. We are drowning in prosperity, and we have no recollection. We have no knowledge of what it took. And meanwhile, we're tearing down science by saying if any standard of excellence has a disparate impact on Black and Hispanic students, we should tear it down. We should get rid of credentializing in medicine. We should credentialize on the basis of race, not knowledge of medicine. We should hire and promote on the basis of race, not knowledge of how to save a cancer victim or how to solve a heart attack victim. The federal government under Biden is handing out billions of dollars of federal taxpayer money based not on who is the best oncologist or who is the best neurologist to try and cure Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease, but who has the darkest skin color. But of course, if you're East Asian, that doesn't count. Or if you're an Indian, that doesn't count. In fact, our science profession right now is extraordinarily multinational, multicultural, multiracial. The only groups who are not proportionally represented are Blacks and Hispanics. And that's not because of racism. It's because of the skills gap. It's because the grasp of math and science concepts is so low. That's a problem that begins in the family. It begins in a culture of anti-academic achievement. It begins in stigmatizing academic effort as acting white. That's what has to change. We should not be tearing down our standards, Megan, but we are a culture now that is engaged in self-loathing. And when the West tears itself down, there's going to be nothing left. The mob can destroy, it cannot create. And we'll see what happens if the West continuously self-cancels. China will take over. I mean, they are now beating us in many types of nanotechnologies because they do care about merit. They're not handing scientific and math privileges out based on identity politics. They're saying, I'm going to find the best math talent among the student body, and I'm going to throw everything we've got. Meanwhile, America is tearing down gifted and talented programs because of the usual race issue. And we're tearing down our criminal law enforcement because of the usual race issue. This is how a society destroys excellence and civilization.
Mm. They've been using the term Selma envy to describe a lot of these students, right? They're just so desperate
to be
part of something that matters, and they missed that particular movement. And so now they're finding something else and falsely trying to compare themselves to people who actually did suffer and didn't endure a lot in order to change this country. by claiming they're on a hunger strike when really they're ordering sushi to their George Soros-funded tent, by claiming, you know, woe is me while they're sneaking off for a little salsa dancing, by, as Ilhan Omar's daughter, who went to Barnard, she goes there now, was suspended in connection with one of these protests, calling herself now homeless because she got suspended temporarily, and saying she was the victim of a chemical weapons attack, Heather, because one of the students sprayed a gas, meaning fart spray, on campus that is non-toxic. It says so on the bottle. And she, without mentioning that's what happened, just goes on MSNBC and says, I was the victim of a chemical weapons attack. Sure, sure you were, Isla, or Isra, whatever her name is.
I mean, we're basically putting a target on our backs and saying, come and invade. I mean, this is such a decadent society. We do not have martial virtues anymore. I wish I could send these people in to comment. Obviously, nobody wants to be at war, but these are people who are living a fiction and are completely soft. We have lost any sense of realism and martial virtues. It is completely pathetic, but it all comes to, I remember in the 1990s, you would have faculty writing op-eds in the New York Times saying, oh, where's the student protest? No, you know what? Here's the only thing you're obliged to do and should do on a college campus is learn, shut up and learn some history. Shut up and learn some chemistry. Shut up and learn some literature. Listen to Mozart, listen to Brahms, listen to Chopin, study Tiepolo, study John Milton, study the periodic table. You have 4 years to confront and absorb the greatness of people who went before you, who make you look like pygmies. You should really not be heard. We don't care what you think. Conservatives make the mistake of saying, oh, well, college is all about debate and free speech and critical thinking. Yeah, I'm a little less enamored of that concept. What it should be really about is cramming as much knowledge into the empty noggins of these pathetic crybabies as is possible in 4 years. And then if you want to go out after college and debate whether Trump is a fascist or how many sex organs we should lop off of adolescents today, that's fine. But right now, you should be devoted to one thing, and that is overcoming your embarrassing ignorance about the world and your place in it.
That is so well said. I've got to play this soundbite. I'm going to front it by telling you, I don't know exactly how he got it or whether he was there, but Rudy Giuliani posted it on X of a student and her friend who were at the NYU protest. And listen to this exchange, Heather.
And what would you say is the main goal with tonight's protest?
I think the goal is just showing our support for Palestine and demanding that NYU stops. I honestly don't know all of what NYU's doing.
Is there something that NYU's doing?
I really don't know. I'm pretty sure they're... Do you know what NYU's doing?
About what?
About Israel. Why are we protesting here?
Palestine will be free!
I wish I was more educated.
I'm not either.
Yes, we all wish that.
I came from Columbia. I was there above Columbia, and we came down. They said NYU students needed our support. So I came down. I heard there's lots of cops. Some people were saying it was getting dangerous.
Heather.
It is so ridiculous. Again, it is coded. They're doing this because they're in a college campus. And time is running out. The school year's ending. What will they do when they don't have the bureaucrats to go around handing them out little cookies and saying, well, we're going to negotiate. You can pretend like you're hostages and we're negotiating with you and you're in danger. They'll be thrown out into the real world and there'll be nobody to negotiate with. Now they've got this bunting. They're like little babies swaddled by all of the DEI bureaucrats and the student services bureaucrats and the vice presidents of first-gen students. And it's a marvelous, they are codependent addicts. They're addicted to melodrama and to fiction because they are living in fictional worlds. They are not oppressed in America. They have more freedom than has ever been experienced in all of human history. And yet they live in a world that perversely celebrates victimhood They, by self-acclamation, they know nothing. Let's give them a map with all of the countries' names wiped out, and let's see if they can even find Gaza on a map, much less Jordan, the Golan Heights, Syria, Iran. Cannot do it. This is completely as much of a social contagion as the trans thing is. It is adolescents striving to have power over adults, which is what every adult craves, whether it's claiming that you've been misgendered and so you can crush an adult under your thumb, or claiming that you are in solidarity with Palestine and therefore are yourself somehow a victim. It gives adolescents power, and that's what they crave. And
woman can find her way back to Colombia. I'm not sure she's going to be able to do it, given her knowledge base there. Why are we here again? I wish I were better educated. We all do, sweetheart. By the way, that Isra Omar is the Jussie Smollett of the Colombia protests. She's a faker. She was not attacked by a chemical weapon. She is not homeless. She is somebody who is looking for fake victimhood, like so many her young age are. There's so much to get to, but I want to show this. We're on the subject of the salsa and the sushi and the fake chemical weapons attacks, and how none of these people is really a victim at these $85,000 a year schools. I bring you the dance. Heather, they've taken to dancing to express, I guess, their outrage over the Jews. I'm not exactly sure, but take a look. Last one's the best. By the way, we got those on X from Via Catch and Ollie London. But, you know, nothing says I'm really outraged at all the killing like a little interpretive dance.
Well, sadly, I can't see it. I can hear it, though, and I can imagine. So I am also going to have to watch it later. But again, it's just decadence. That's all it is. And it's performative decadence. And it wouldn't be if the adults on campus had not abdicated their authority. This wouldn't be happening. This all began in the 60s when you had the capitulation to the militants back then. It continues in an academic intellectual sphere with adults who are supposed to be the scholars on campus saying, oh, we're not going to tell you what you need to learn before you graduate. You can just pick your own curriculum, and no student knows enough to do that. So adults are really leveling themselves, debasing themselves to the level of these ignoramus students, and they don't deserve their salaries. They don't deserve to be having this privilege of being on a university campus. In theory, there's no greater activity or profession, as far as I'm concerned, Megan, than being in a university and being a curator of this great tradition. These are the luckiest people on earth, these professors. All we ask of them is to tell students, this is greatness. Be down on your knees in front of greatness. And instead, the adults have engaged in their own little play acting of pretending that they too are you know, fighting neoliberalism and engaged in action, you know, ethnic studies. It's all about action, activism. That's not what scholarship is about. But they too have completely swerved from what is their mission. And these campuses are profoundly unserious.
What do you make of this, though, Heather? Because, you know, Scott Galloway, he's a professor. He was on MSNBC this morning with Morning Joe, and he was making good points about, he's been on this show before as well, about how if you were to say one word about Blacks or Hispanics in the way that they're speaking about Jews, you'd be off campus. He was saying, you know, he would have been kicked out of, I think it's NYU where he's a professor, like that, right? There'd be no, well, let's discuss nuance, let's discuss free speech. He would have been kicked out. And then he went on to talk about what's happening with young people today. I know this is a subject near and dear to him. He talks about it a lot. Probably as a university professor, he's exposed to a lot of them. And here's a bit of what he said. Take a listen.
For the first time in our nation's history, a 30-year-old man or woman isn't doing as well as his or her parents were at 30. That is the social compact breaking down. People aged 30 to 34, 60% of them in 1990 had one child. Now it's 27%. People are opting out of America. They're not optimistic about it. They're not having kids. Young people aren't having sex. They're not meeting. They're not mating. The pool of emotionally and economically viable men shrinks every day, which lessens household formation. So we have a real issue. Young people are enraged. So it turns every cut, every movement into an opportunistic infection because, quite frankly, they are just pissed off. Mm-hmm. They look up, they see wealth, exceptional wealth across my generation and people in certain industries, and they are really struggling. Their purchasing power is going down, and the incumbents create artificial scarcity on campus. We take pride in rejecting 90% of our applicants. So the incumbents who already have a degree see their degree go up in value. We get very concerned with housing and traffic once we own a housing. Housing permits are sequestered from young people. Housing prices have gone from 290 to 420 in the last 4 years. So a young person, a house, stocks that I don't own skyrocket in value. Let's have COVID relief and flush the markets and take assets way up, because if a million people dying would be bad, would be tragic if I got less wealthy. And we're doing it on their credit card. Young people have every reason to be enraged, and every issue they see, they look up, they get angry, and they see someone doing better than them. And then every day it is speedballed in their face that they are failing, that they are not doing as well as everyone around them. We have lost the script. Our kids are more anxious and more depressed and more obese and more addicted. And we have made a purposeful decision to let this happen by ensuring the people around this table stay wealthy at the cost of young people.
What do you make of it, Heather?
I disagree. I think it's all over the map. I refuse to say that young people are victims. I don't believe they even know about housing costs. Their problems are that they feel sorry for themselves. I do not believe that if you are a hard worker, you stay away from drugs, you work hard, that you do not have a chance still in this world. Yes, it's true. They're not having sex. You know why? Because we're celebrating non-procreative sex all the time. 30%, as we've heard and some high schools identify as LGBTQ. That is what Gay Pride March is about. We are always celebrating non-procreative couplings, and we have no respect for the traditional heterosexual family. I think Galloway leaves out the ideology that is involved here, where we have an anti-male ideology. There's fewer and fewer viable young men because we keep telling them that they are the source of all problems. Good luck getting any kind of positive reinforcement if you're a young boy. Every foundation, the federal government, every state government has You Go Girl programs up the gazoo. Girls who code, we want more girls in STEM. Boys are an afterthought. This is ideological. It is not an economic problem. I'm not going to feel sorry for young people today. They are participants in their own marginalization by embracing this victim ideology. And the problem is that we are turning against the fundamental bourgeois values of respect for authority, respect for the family, and understanding that males and females are different, that mothers and fathers are different.
And
we should
respect for oneself. I got to take a quick pause because I got to get a break in here, but much more. Heather stays with us. This is why I love her. Heather is all about the bootstraps, and so am I. I'm Megyn Kelly, host of The Megyn Kelly Show on Sirius XM. It's your home for open, honest, and provocative conversations with the most interesting and important political, legal, and cultural figures today. You can catch The Megyn Kelly Show on Triumph, a Sirius XM channel featuring lots of hosts you may know and probably love. Great people like Dr. Laura, Glenn Beck, Nancy Grace, Dave Ramsey, and yours truly, Megyn Kelly. You can stream The Megyn Kelly Show on Sirius XM at home or anywhere you are, no car required. I do it all the time. I love the Sirius XM app. It has ad-free music, coverage of every major sport, comedy, talk, podcast, and more. Subscribe now. Get your first 3 months for free.
Go to SiriusXM.com/MKShow to subscribe and get 3 months free. That's SiriusXM.com/MKShow and get 3 months free. Offer details apply.
Donald Trump, as you know, is on trial now in New York State Supreme. He's facing charges in three other courtrooms as well. And the prosecutor, Alvin Bragg, in New York, had announced these charges a year ago. And the only way he got to bring them was by saying, trust me, it's not just this misdemeanor of falsifying business records, because I realize the statute of limitations has expired on that. He didn't say that, but that's a political reality, a legal reality for him. But he resurrected that claim by saying, I can still bring this dead claim if it was done, this falsification, to cover up another crime. And then everybody looked at the indictment breathlessly and said, what's the other crime? What's the other crime? And he actually looked in the cameras and said, I don't have to tell you. So for a year, we've been speculating, what was it? What is the other crime that he falsified the business records for? And our best speculation has been that Bragg would argue Trump's situation with David Pecker at the National Enquirer to bury bad stories about him and promote bad stories about his adversaries, and to buy the silence of certain women threatening to come forward with affair allegations, that somehow amounted to a campaign finance violation. Okay, that's where we are today. When he actually did the opening argument, not Bragg, but his deputy, this guy Colangelo, it didn't sound anything like that. It sounded all about this, quote, scheme where David Pecker of the National Enquirer and Trump and Trump's lawyer Michael Cohen got together and decided to get the women to sign NDAs in exchange for money because it would be bad for Trump's election if they didn't. That was it. I don't know what that violates. Conspiracy's not charged. I'm not going to make you do legal analysis on this. I'm going someplace with it. But all the lawyers I know truly were looking at the opening like, what? 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 We need an underlying crime. How many steps do we have to go through to get there? How on earth are they ever going to reduce a jury instruction to something digestible by these 12 average humans who are going to have to try to make sense of this and decide whether the prosecution has proved a crime? So that's where we are as of today. Now, instead of sitting back and asking ourselves, maybe Alvin Bragg doesn't have it. Maybe Alvin Bragg's Harvard law education didn't exactly do for him what we had hoped. You've got the Joy Reids of the world who are having a very different reaction, looking at Alvin Bragg going after Trump with an incomprehensible legal theory. Fannie Willis down in Atlanta, who we know is utterly confused by what she's doing. She's probably too busy stupping the boyfriend on the side and then lying under oath about it. And then there's Jack Smith. And then we've got Letitia James in New York, the attorney general, who's gone after Trump and won some $450 million for a civil fraud that hurt absolutely no one. Joy Reid is reveling in this, Heather, as follows. Watch.
For me, there is something wonderfully poetic about the fact that despite the fact that even if convicted, he's not going to go to prison, the first person to actually criminally prosecute Donald Trump is a black Harvard grad, the very kind of person that his former staff, the people who worked for him, Stephen Miller, et cetera, want to never be at Harvard Law School. But he was. And a black woman is doing that same exact thing in Georgia. And a black woman forced you to pay $175 million fine. Donald Trump is being held to account by the very multicultural, multiracial democracy that he's trying to dismantle. And for me, there's something poetic and actually wonderful about that. It says something good about our country that we're still capable of having that happen. Go DEI. My DEIs are bringing it home.
Wow. Something good about our country that we're now playing an absolute race war. That is truly extraordinary. She's asking us to see everything through the lens of race that, you know, so, I mean, it's getting very trite. I'm sick of hearing conservatives kind of plaintively bleat, well, whatever happened to the content of your character? I thought we were supposed to be colorblind, but for sure. I mean, one does have to ask that question. I thought we're not supposed to see race, but of course the left says, if you don't see my race, you're not seeing me, at the same time that they deny that there's any biological reality to race. Sorry, that's anti-science. There is a biological reality to race, and we are trying to silence any kind of research into heritability. But in any case, Reed is basically telling us to see the race of people within the law first, and to expect a sort of race war coming out of the legal profession against a man. This is an absolute violation, leaving aside even the race elements. But she is basically saying this is a vendetta against Donald Trump, against his policies. I knew that we were in a bad situation, Megan, when it comes to the rule of law, but I didn't know it was this bad. But okay, so if Joy Reid wants to play race card, let's look at what's going on. Joe Biden, when he came into office in early 2021, his administration announced that it would no longer be submitting the federal judicial nominees to the ABA for preclearance. This is a tradition whereby presidents say to the American Bar Association, here's people we're thinking about nominating to the federal courts. Are they qualified? Are they super qualified? Are they not qualified? Biden said, we're not going to do that. Why? Because he said, and get this, you will appreciate this, Megan. He said, because the ABA doesn't support diversity. ABA, let me give you a truth nugget here. The ABA is obsessed with diversity. They don't care about merit. All they care about is race. Biden was basically saying, my judicial nominees are going to be so bad that they won't even get by the ABA. 22% of his judicial picks in the first 16 months of his administration were Black females. This is a disaster, Megan, for the following reason. Black female lawyers make up about 2% of the lawyer population. So if you knew nothing more than that, and you're seeing about 22% of nominees and people being put on the bench being Black females, you know he is lowering standards. Let's go a little further. If Joy Reid is making this about race, okay, let's talk about race. When you look at the actual skills of Black law students, they are at the bottom of the barrel. About 2/3 of Black students are in the bottom half of their class. 50% are in the bottom 10th of their class. You cannot have diversity and meritocracy on the bench at the same time. To the extent that you have opted for diversity on the bench, you are by definition going to be lowering the standards of our jurisprudence, the standards of our lawyers, the standards of our judges. This matters. And you are seeing it, as you said, with Megan, in the quality of the lawyering that we're getting. And this is not just some abstract problem. The rule of law depends on clearly articulated standards so that private parties can plan commercial transactions. And it matters, our constitutional jurisprudence matters for maintaining the fundamental principles of our republic. And if we're putting people into law school, onto law faculties, based not on their capacities to do the law and to think about very, very complicated matters, but based on their race, we are watering down our capacity to go forward. And that is what's happening. And again, this is a subject that that nice, well-meaning Americans do not want to talk about. Far from being white supremacists, they are turning their eyes away from inner city Black pathologies. But the reality is this, Megan, the skills gap between Blacks on the one hand and whites and Asians on the other is so high that you cannot have diversity and meritocracy at the same time. Any institution like a university, a federal bar, a law firm that tells you they're opting for diversity is telling you they have discarded meritocratic standards when it comes to hiring and promoting and admitting Blacks.
I see your point entirely, because a meritocracy will allow talented Black people, brown people, Asians, whites, whatever, to rise to the top if they deserve it, if they have, you know, the education and the skills and the hard work ethic and so on. But a system based purely on diversity will not allow those who are most meritorious to rise to the top. If it's based purely on diversity, you're going to be judged by your body parts and your skin color and so on.
It would, in the absence of a skills gap. Here's the reality. 3% of Black seniors are ready for a career in STEM. 3%. 3% are ready for college. And yet we have many more being pushed into these fields. 66% of all Black 12th graders do not possess even partial mastery of the most basic 12th grade math skills, such as being able to do arithmetic or reading a graph. 66% of Black 12th graders cannot do that even partially. And yet you have our standard now of saying, if we don't have 13% oncologists in the most advanced cancer research labs, it's because of discrimination against qualified Black cancer researchers. No, it's because they are not in the pipeline. The skills gap, 50% of Black 12th graders do not possess even partial mastery of 12th grade reading. Again, if you are expecting 13% Black representation in meritocratic, demanding cognitive skills, demanding occupations, you are not going to get that without lowering standards. The problem is the skills gap, and that is not a problem of racism. It is a problem of family culture. And so again, if we're going to go around saying that any racial disparity is the product of racism, and that's what the left is saying, I just read today that a Pennsylvania convenience store chain is being sued for racial discrimination because it uses background checks to screen for employees. And guess what? Blacks commit crime at so much higher rates that they get knocked out by criminal background checks. That's not because the checks are racist. Here's the reality, Megan. In the post-George Floyd crime wave that we're still living through, Black juveniles are shot at 100 times the rate of white juveniles. Why? They're not being shot by police officers. They're not being shot by whites. They're being shot by other Blacks at 100 times the rate of white juvenile shootings. That's the reality we're living with, and that's the reality that the left does not want you to see.
That's so awful. Never placed on a BLM sign or in the George Floyd riots. Nothing about those stats. But we are hearing more and more on the left this touting of record low crime rate. Of course, this is to help Joe Biden get elected. But they're citing, there is someone who does this analysis named Jeff Asher. He's a crime analyst. He wrote a December 2023 article on it for his newsletter talking about this 50-year decline in the crime rate. And we heard a bunch of folks over on MSNBC touting this. I'll give you just an example to set it up for the audience. SOT 10.
Violent crime at nearly a 50-year low.
The facts are the facts. Crime is near a 50-year low. Let me say that again. Crime in America is near a 50-year low.
Last year, the murder rate saw the sharpest decrease in history. Violent crime fell to one of its lowest levels in more than 50 years.
On Earth One, the FBI reports that violent crime in America is at a 50-year low.
And migrant crime is not a thing.
What do you make of that, Heather? Because I know it's one of those things to me where it's like, don't believe your lying eyes. With all the crime in front of you and in your local paper and happening to your neighbor, believe this analysis from this guy, Jeff Asher, repeated by MSNBC, printed in The Atlantic as America's peace wave, and so on.
It's smoke and mirrors. Even Asher admitted in the study that they're all quoting that crime is still way up over 2019. The post-George Floyd crime epidemic, the anarchy that has broken out ever since we celebrated rioters, ever since we celebrated looting, ever since we celebrated shooting at police officers, destroying police precincts, courthouses, that has not gone away. And Asher admitted that. He's looking at third quarter rates of 2023. We don't have the full 2023 data, but here's the reality, Megan. Carjackings in 2023 are still up 93% compared to pre-George Floyd race riots of 2019. Car thefts are up 105% compared to 2019. Homicides are up 18%. And if you go back further to when the real glorification of, frankly, Black crime began in 2014 with the whole Michael Brown hands up, don't shoot narrative, that was completely false, but that was amplified by the mainstream media and CNN and MSNBC. Homicides are up 40% in 2022 compared to 2014. The reality today remains anarchy, unlike we've ever seen. The types of lootings, the shameless strolls through supermarkets and convenience stores and jewelry stores with people without any fear of punishment, just dumping goods into their knapsacks. We've never had to lock up toothpaste before. This is not a mark of a civilization. The basic obligation of government is to protect property, the expectation of small business owners. It is not doing that. This is a crime wave that is completely voluntary. It is a creation of bad political government choices that are based on the same issue that if criminal law enforcement has a disparate impact on Black criminals, it must be racist law enforcement. And so we have decided, or the elites have decided, we are not going to enforce the law because we would rather put up with more Black crime and more Black victimization than put more Black criminals in jail. And the results speak for themselves. This is not a mirage. It's not a phantom. There was a Washington Post reporter that was bitching about, a moral panic over shoplifting and mass theft in crime in property. It's not a moral panic. If government cannot protect law-abiding citizens and their expectations of safety and the safety of their property, that is a failed government that has lost its legitimacy.
The problem is widespread, and the news media is complicit, as you know. There are a couple of examples of this that I'd like to get to, but before I do, I just want to mention on the Daily Mail just this morning, Walmart removes self-checkouts and swaps back to traditional lanes, but it's not because they care about customer service. It's happening in Missouri and Ohio, because people are stealing. They can't be trusted to go through the self-checkout. And as you know, everything is under lock and key now. Shampoo. Yeah. You know, it used to be the stuff that people could use like Sudafed to make drugs. And now everything, call attendant. It's just such a hassle to go, which is of course why none of us want to go to these stores anymore. We just want to use Amazon, funding the lifestyle of Jeff Bezos and his weird wife. This morning in Los Angeles, there was a stabbing. Listen to this, Heather. So it happened, Monday morning, 5 a.m., but the videotape has just made the news. 67-year-old woman fatally stabbed, Myrna Souza Arauz, stabbed in the throat. It was unprovoked. She was stabbed as she was exiting the train onto the platform area. The police reported out a description of the male. He's since been arrested, and this is how they reported it. Take a listen to the KTLA report.
Victim stabbed in the throat. The ambulance was called and the woman was treated by paramedics, but no word on the extent of her injuries or her condition right now. As for the suspect, police say it was a man carrying two bags. We don't have any other description at this point.
So this woman did later die, and it later came out. They found the assailant, and it was a Black man. He's under arrest now. They strongly believe that he may have victimized other people, and they urged anyone who believed they were targeted by him to come forward. Police now say he has a troubling, violent criminal history, including previous assaults. He did 4 years in prison on an assault with a deadly weapon and an enhancement for inflicting great bodily injury. He served about half the sentence before he was released in 2022. So they won't say, in trying to track down the man while he was still at large, the color of his skin. And of course, they would never have withheld that if it had been a white man.
It's suicide. I mean, we have just decided we're going to cancel ourselves. You cannot go around coddling criminals on the some phony theory of racial justice. And, you know, I'll play the black card here. If you don't put away black criminals, it's going to be primarily disproportionately blacks who are victimized. Dozens of blacks are shot every day fatally by other blacks. This is unbelievable. That's more than all white and Hispanic homicide victims combined, even though blacks are only 13% of the population. So if your only concern is black lives, you should be wanting to lock people away. But let's also not pretend that there is not huge interracial crime issues that goes in the exact opposite than what we're told by the mainstream media. If you look at all non-lethal interracial violence between blacks and whites and whites and blacks, and I say non-lethal because this is based on self-reporting. So if you're dead, you can't self-report. But the National Crime Victimization Survey shows us that blacks commit about 87% of all interracial violence between blacks and whites and whites and blacks. A black person is 33 times more likely to commit a stabbing, a drive-by shooting, a rape, a robbery against a white than vice versa. The narrative is the exact opposite, and it's true for cops as well, Megan. We're all supposed to believe that blacks are at huge risk from police officers. The reality is the opposite. In 2021, a police officer was 400 times more likely to be killed by a black person than an unarmed black was to be likely to be fatally shot by a police officer. So if the libertarians among us, if the cop haters among us, like Radley Balco, go around saying how safe it is to be a police officer, notwithstanding the spate of fatal shootings of police officers during car stops, not just in New York, but last week in Memphis, Tennessee, that it's so great to be a police officer. Well, it's 400 times safer to be a black person vis-a-vis the cops as it is to be a cop vis-a-vis a black person. So everything the public thinks it knows about race, crime, and policing from the mainstream media is wrong. Reverse it and you have the truth. It's blacks who are killing each other. Police are the solution to black lives being lost. They are not the source of black lives being lost. If you care about blacks, you should want to have strong law enforcement. And we should, from now on, the rule should be, Megan, this is not normal what we're living through. This is a self-created, chosen life that we're inflicting on ourselves. No more second chances. I'm sorry. No more.
No, it's true. I have been to the south side of Chicago, and it's sad. It's depressing. It's heartbreaking. I've met with the moms whose half their sons are in prison. Their husbands they split. There's not a father in the family. They're supportive of one another. These moms live in fear when their kids go outside that they're going to get shot, that they're going to get pulled into gang violence. They don't know what to do. Of course, they're for, you know, this sort of restorative justice where we're less harsh in the penalties because it's all their family members. And they've been totally abandoned by the system. They've been forgotten about. No one cared about them during the BLM riots. No one was talking about their communities. They stifled it all. Just this month, just as my daughter celebrated her 13th birthday, an 8-year-old girl and seven others, the girl was killed. Seven others were wounded, including a 1-year-old boy and a 7-year-old boy, each shot multiple times in Chicago. And they said this was not a random act. This was likely gang related. Of course, the CNN article about it goes on to blame guns. Firearms are the number one killer of children and teens in America. Okay. It's not, you know how many guns there are in Dallas? This doesn't happen there. This happens in Chicago, and they won't get honest about the problem. By the way, for all those people on MSNBC singing about the lovely crime-free America we now live in, in 2024, homicides of children, we took a look, 0 to 14. This year, just as of April 23rd, it's already at 14. In all of 2023, it was 17. This is just in Chicago. Children, 14 and under. In all of last year, it was 17. We're already at 14 in April. It goes on. So we've forgotten about this group of Americans who are suffering because we won't get honest about what's actually killing them. And at the same time, Chicagoans are protesting the death of Dexter Reed, this guy who pulled out his gun when pulled over by cops, shot at them first, and then they unleashed 96 rounds against him, demanding that the cops be fired and prosecuted. There was a big protest about it just the other day at the Chicago Police Board meeting, saying the problem in his death was the, quote, pretextual traffic stop and not anything other than that. They're not protesting about what's happening with these kids and the dead 8-year-old girl, Heather.
Well, I'm so sick of Black Lives Matter activists and their ilk. It's just preposterous. They don't deserve a single moment of any of our time. I will believe that they believe that Black Lives Matter activists when I see a single protest about these Black children that are gunned down. It has never happened once. Al Sharpton has never been there once. Benjamin Crump has never been there once. They don't give a damn. This is all about attacking white people. It's based on hatred of white people that we're supposed to pretend that whites are the problem in these Black communities or the police are the problem in these Black communities. No, the fathers who are absent are the problem in these Black communities. The lack of parenting, of decent parenting, is the problem of these Black communities. Gun control is not the issue. It's lack of impulse control. These are kids that have been not, they don't have socialization. They, if they feel dissed, they pull out a gun and they randomly shoot across city sidewalks and they don't care who they shoot at. America turns its eyes away. Again, let's remember, we're supposed to believe we're a white supremacist society. Instead, we are not. We don't even want to talk about Black crime anymore because it makes white people feel bad. We somehow blame ourselves for this.
Yes, you feel... You feel offensive or somehow, I don't know, it makes you feel uncomfortable. You're not generalizing, of course, about all Black people at all, but we need to get honest about what the actual crime rate is, where it's coming from, and why before we'll ever solve it. You've been saying that for years. And to your point, one other thing, the national homicide rate in 2022 was 40% higher than it was in 2014, pre-Michael Brown. And whenever we see one of these things, Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, George Floyd, the media participates. They create a firestorm around race and Blacks and whites and cops. And every time what happens is more Black people die. More Blacks die because cops pull back. The inner cities are ignored. Gang violence goes up. The next thing you know, an 8-year-old girl is dead. A 1-year-old and 7-year-old boy are shot in the head. No one's paying any attention to it. It's just, how many times do we have to go through this cycle, right? And still, that same community is pointing to a totally justified police-involved shooting that was only unleashed once they were shot upon. It's just, we're not solving anything.
Well, they voted for Brandon Johnson. You know, it was the West Side and the South Side that got in to the mayoralty in Chicago, a guy who was on record as a sort of a defund the police type. And he goes around saying these are crimes of people that have children that have been denied opportunity. This is just BS. Let's get this one off the table as well, Megan. These are not crimes of necessity. There's almost no crimes of necessity. These are crimes of entitlement. These are crimes of people who feel that they are justified in taking other people's property just because it's owed them. The smartphone, social media is the police's biggest friend because all these kids have smartphones and they throw their gang signs on the phones. They show off their guns. They show off their money. They show off their bling. Any child who has a smartphone is not deprived. And you know, we're also supposed to believe from the left, oh, this is all because of COVID and lockdowns and whatnot. No, excuse me. The only place where crime went up in the world, violent crime rose during the COVID pandemic was the United States. And that's because we stopped enforcing the law. It was because it was after George Floyd when crime went up. This was not the result of lockdowns. Crime went down every place else. And it is not the fault of somehow poverty or deprivation. These kids are not poor. They are poor in social capital. They have not been taught to defer gratification, to control their impulses. And of course, we are not speaking about all Blacks. I've made a career out of going into community inner city meetings with the police and giving voice to these good law-abiding Black people, elderly residents who are terrified to go into the street, who are terrified to go into their building lobby, because it's been colonized by youth who are trespassing, smoking weed, selling drugs. They beg the police, arrest the dealers, keep them off the streets, arrest the truant school children. Why don't you arrest them for loitering any longer? Those people deserve to be heard. You said they've been abandoned by people. No, the people who care are like white conservatives. When the white conservative media stops caring about Black lives, then they're really screwed. But as long as the Democrats are in power, they're going to continue to be screwed because nobody wants to look at the pathologies head on, and least of all the Democrats.
Yeah, you're not going to hear any of those stats from Rachel Maddow or Morning Joe. They're just, or Joe Biden. They're just going to celebrate. It's solved. It's all great. All right, we'll end it on a happy note, on a piece of good news. This we got via End Wokeness on X. We love that account, of retweeting ex-user Kevin Dalton. Is law and order returning to Los Angeles? A suspect breaks into a home. There was an immediate and overwhelming police response. The nonviolent criminal goes to jail on $100,000 bail. Yay. Okay, this is progress. What changed? Oh, I see. It's the home of LA Mayor Karen Bass. A person who she was home when it happened. She's fine. They sent air support to that one, Heather. Karen Bass, who introduced the George Floyd policing bill in Congress, banned chokeholds, banned no-knock warrants at the federal level, eliminated qualified immunity for law enforcement, and established a national police misconduct registry. Once police held accountable, she got air support sent to her house. And the guy's in jail for that one. Regular Los Angeles, different story, black or white. You're not going to get the star treatment. This woman, it's police for me, but not for thee. I'll give you the last word, my friend.
Vote her out. I mean, you know, we've heard the expression conservatives or liberals who've been mugged by reality. I doubt whether Bass is going to turn into a conservative, but people got to vote. They got to vote out George Gascon, the left-wing prosecutor in L.A., we still have, believe it or not, we do have the power of the ballot. These people are hypocrites. They look out for themselves. They have lost all sense of what a government exists to do, which is to protect the law-abiding, not to protect the dysfunctional, not to protect the antisocial. It is time to get back to a respect for people who play by the rules. Those are the people who deserve the support of government, not those who want to tear everything down. We've got to take our system back, Megan, and we still have the power to do it as long as people show up and vote.
Well said. Heather McDonald, enjoy Vienna. Thank you for making time for us when you have all this beauty and wonder around you. Great to see you.
Better talk with you, Megan. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to The Megyn Kelly Show. No BS, no agenda, and no fear.